Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I've been asked many times over the years to introduce some basic theological and even scriptural elements for people who don't understand the ancient point of view in the matter. This is a matter for historians, which automatically makes it problematic. And it's really been something that I spent a ridiculous amount of time on. I am not a theologian. That's a separate issue entirely. And a theologian is not someone who understands the basic theories and ideas that have developed historically. That I am. No, it's someone who actually knows God. And that I do not. At least not in the sense that most people, they mean the term. But I want to talk about general things like interpretation, how to approach unfamiliar concepts, how to deal with people in these absolutely fundamental issues. And by the way, if I sound a little odd, I just sent $1,000 to the government and back taxes. So if I say anything weird, just, you know, please, my stomach still hurts a little bit. What we have today in America is such a morass. It's such an anti-intellectual, subjective, just purely Nietzschean, egocentric approach to theology. And I, to this day, I can't wrap my brain around the fact that people bet their souls on what they think they know about questions that they think are important. With the very paltry store of knowledge, or actually the non-existent store of knowledge, that the alienated Westerner has, even the educated, even the best-intentioned educated Westerner has today, they simply can't make that jump into any kind of reality. So, how do we approach this stuff? I mean, the first thing, of course, as a historian, you know, I'm asked, you know, the historical background. You're trying to interpret, you know, Bible passages. Remember, the Bible and Scripture are two very different things. The written word is a very slippery idea. Nothing is based on the written word. The written word is an abbreviation for something far more powerful. The ideas of literary context, historical cultural background, this is a matter for historians. And since there are about 7 competent historians on the planet, this ends up being a disaster just by itself. Culture, I mean, the whole big question is, how can an alienated Westerner living in this media bubble possibly get anything good out of a set of documents written thousands of years ago? In a culture that not only do they have absolutely no access to, but is the exact opposite of what they're used to. And the answer is that they can't. They can't get any good out of it. And I'm hopefully helping people to dig out of this morass with a few words here. I've spoken many, many times about the use of words and symbols and concepts that have far more depth in the ancient world than today. There are really no symbols today. People think a symbol is the opposite of substance, which is the exact opposite of what a symbol is. The ancient mind in general saw manifestations. Objects were actually manifestations of a larger whole. They weren't objects in and of themselves. I mean, certainly an object had a meaning in use, but it also had a meaning for moral interpretation, historical meaning, and even as a manifestation of divine energy. And then all of this was connected in a network of meaning. This is the ancient culture, and this is has a divine root. When I say object, I can mean anything, the concept of justice, household, whatever it is. So symbols are connected to other symbols, and a symbol really is a point of intersection between the heavenly and the earthly realms. It's our initiation, so to speak. So a quick example here. Psalm 50. If thou had desired sacrifice, would have given it. With burnt offering, thou would not be delighted. A sacrifice to God, an afflicted spirit, a contrite and humble heart, O God, you will not despise. Deal favorably, O Lord, thy goodwill, with Zion, that the walls of Jerusalem may be built up. Then thou shalt accept the sacrifice of justice, oblation, and whole burnt offerings. Then they shall lay calves upon thine altar. Now, Psalm 50 is one of the essential penitential psalms in the entire history of the church. And yet, most of the symbols that I just read to you here are completely opaque to not only just the average well-intentioned man, but certainly the professors of divinity. The first thing you notice, of course, is that Israelite sacrifices were condemned. Israelites generally were condemned most of the time as taking everything God had given them for granted. But these sacrifices, these rituals, were really done for the sake of gain. They were not done in the spirit of repentance, and they were done mechanically. In the book of Amos, the prophet says that God hates, and these offerings are a stench to me. What God wants is a crushed heart. Now, the heart is not merely an organ in our chest. It was deeper than the intellect. It was a synthesis of thought, feeling, memory, and identity. And even more than the soul, because it was connected with everything else. Your whole being had to be humbled, not just your mind. But as soon as this is done, God forgives. But then and only then can you then approach God. Can the old services be done properly? The old liturgical services be done properly? And this is, you know, the requirement that communion be preceded by some form of confession, permission by your spiritual father, which is what confession is. And all past sins and hang-ups have been dealt with and rectified. Approaching God in that case becomes a matter of blasphemy, unless it's done, is a matter of blasphemy. But modernity destroyed all this. In modern epistemology, objects don't exist. Because really an object is just a bunch of smaller objects put together by some, either a natural process or the mind. So the human body is made up of organs. Organs are made up of cells. Cells are made up of, we could go all the way down to subatomic particles. So what do you have left? Empty space. Energy. The object ceases to exist entirely. You end up with Nietzsche's flux. So modernity, really post-modernity, the decomposition of the object, which, by the way, includes ourselves, our will, our history, leads to the void. There's nothing stable enough to provide meaning, to provide any kind of meaning. And this is really what the postmodern world is. Now, what I did with Psalm 50, that piece of it, the Psalms are poems. That means words are chosen for their cultural and symbolic value. As society gets more and more degenerate, it gets farther and farther away from these terms and their meaning. Even the beginning understand these meanings. But if you don't know what these symbols are, then they're simply words. In other words, what Americans tend to do is, you know, read these passages just like they're reading any other book. But these words don't mean what they meant, even 100 years ago, let alone 3,000 years ago. Terms like love, heart, sin, death, Hades, prostitution, adultery, they're used in very, very symbolic ways that, frankly, very few people have access to anymore. Just for the two examples, prostitution and adultery. These are used by the prophets all the time. And it can refer to a few things. It can refer to the pagan use of a ritual prostitution prior to entering to the temple, which would be the demonic version of confession. Remember, pagan temples were also banks, and money was considered a talisman. So the prostitute became a symbol of its power. And of course, adultery and whoring are used by all the prompts for all of those who run after other gods for the sake of gain. Those are the same. You leave the truth because the image, rather than the reality, is more attractive to you. It's a perversion of mind, where objects take on a different cast because of human passions and desires impose themselves on it. So, for example, the Israelites began to worship the god Moloch, the devourer of children. The city of Tyre was the archetypal commercial trading city. Its people founded Carthage and Venice. The domination of money and finance required the sacrifice of children to ensure success. This goes back, this is a primal drive. And all sea-based powers, commercial powers, have this drive. Death, people refer to death as if they know what they're talking about. Well, it's a place, it's a state. Hades and hell are two very different things. Hades is a place of semi-existence. It's the realm of death. It could mean something as simple as a separation of the soul from the body, but it could also mean someone who lives solely for material pleasures. These people are also dead. Living in sin is living in death. But when you live in a society where everything is reduced to quantity, all is really something like death is, it's just a cessation of a heartbeat or brain waves, which of course is probably the least significant use of the term. So just these handful of terms and ideas and their ideological background inform a huge amount of just basic Old Testament stuff that make really, you know, without understanding this, make reading it really a mockery. What it comes down to is when you're dealing with people here, breaking down the commonplace use of words, you know, trying to use modern translations that use 21st century concepts to describe events in, you know, 2000 BC is a struggle. You know, this is why you have the church fathers. If you're cut off from the church fathers, you don't know anything. These are the men who put the Bible together over a period of, or actually for a lengthy period of time. But when you're dealing with people individually, you have to understand what they take as convincing. Sometimes it's just your example. Other times they need an intellectual argument. Sometimes they need more specific practical examples. Some require more striking imagery. And some are simply too stupid. And they don't know because they don't want to know. The abbot Ephrem of Mount Athos says this: "The chief cause of criticism and slander is pride and egotism, for man thinks himself better than others. For this reason, it's very beneficial for a person to think himself smaller than all, that he sees the brother as better, in order that he may help, with the help of God, to be delivered from this evil. I beg, do not criticize one another, for it is egotism through and through. Let brother excuse the fault of brother. This is testimony of humility and love. The brother who does this will find much grace. One that judges and scandalizes his neighbor must know that he will find nothing. And if he has any, he will lose it in order to learn the lesson of humility through misfortune." Well, many of us know these lessons extremely well. And they should govern how we approach these topics. This does not, however, mean that we do not speak the truth. Whenever there's any kind of criticism, it's not done for the sake of any egotistical gain. Certainly none of this is in my interest whatsoever. Most people have gained nothing from a worldly point of view in doing this. But when you're dealing with people, when you're approaching this with others, you're really trying to transport someone into a different world. And you have to do it gently. And unfortunately, we know that this has to be preceded by some kind of traumatic event. The point here is the farther this society gets away from any kind of actual reality, other than the media bubble it lives in, the more ridiculous it seems that any product of this society can read something like the Psalms and have any clue what's going on. The words don't mean the same. The cultural context doesn't mean the same. And things that, you know, an alienated postmodern will take for granted, of course, were, you know, laughable at the time, including the very nature of the individual itself. So at the absolute fundamental, there is no commensurability between the ancient and the postmodern worlds. Now, it used to be, I would start conversations by saying, you know, everything you know is either incorrect or a caricature, which doesn't get you very far. But nominalism, as I've said many times before, is the great enemy. It's the great destroyer. It's the revolution in thought, the late Middle Ages, that holds that objects have no intrinsic meaning and have no intrinsic relationship to their surrounding. What that means, ultimately, is that objects are reducible to words. And really, it's a default method of thinking in most Western societies, in all Western societies. You can't harmonize this, which is the default way that people think, and none of us are excluded there. Nothing in Bible or scriptures can be remotely harmonized with that mentality. It is a frighteningly bizarre way of thinking from the point of view, say, of the Old Testament, the New Testament, or even 500 years ago. And when these things are being written, they're assuming that their readers are not infected by something that many of them had no conception of. So you could simply say, if things, you know, if this is true, if nominalism has any truth to it, and if things are merely just individual words, then do they have a purpose? Well, they couldn't, by definition. A purpose requires a universal meaning. But if the nature around us is so dead and meaningless, from whence does our understanding come from? Ultimately, it comes from those with power. They craft reality any way they see fit because they define the meaning in words. And none of us have escaped from it. It's a cross between the worst utilitarianism and the will to power. Unless that mentality is broken, you can't win. You can't speak of symbols to someone who believes, either through default, that nominalism is true. It will be nonsense to them and frustrating to you. Words, symbols, numbers, rituals, these all have iconic meaning. If you think of words as paintings, complex webs of meaning that connect with everything else. But in the industrialized world, that doesn't make any sense anymore. They're cut off from even basic cognition. So St. Peter of Damascus says this: "For the ordinary initial faith of the Orthodox is born of natural knowledge, and from this faith are born devotion to God, fasting and vigil, reading and psalmody, prayer, and the questioning of those with experience. It is such practices that give birth to the soul's virtues, that is, to the constant observance of the commandments and of moral conduct." Now, this is a common view of the ancient world. The knowledge of an individual thing is essentially its relation to everything else. It's a system of knowledge which you're immersed into. And of course, the system doesn't come from nowhere. It points beyond itself. And this is the very definition of science that Aristotle used. Systems are based on law, of course, but law can't come from the system itself. So from the object, you could solely be raised to questions about the spirit. This could be an important method for dealing with history and context and meaning in any biblical passage or any theological discussion whatsoever. Nothing in liturgy, nothing in ritual is accidental. These are all part of this painting, this tapestry. Now, the overwhelming majority of people who approach it have no idea what they're looking at. But to make it simpler, you come across people who say that God commands that you will not kill. Of course, that assumes we know what killing is. God commands his people to kill lots of people all the time. Every Christian empire in history has been militarized. That's what an empire is. Well, since the writers of the Old Testament and those who put it together were not idiots, kill can't mean what it means to us today. It really meant to harm an Israelite or to murder. What it comes down to is that God divided the world into two camps, the chosen and the reprobate. The reprobate, unfortunately, are not especially God, since so many of them end up dead, as in the flood, for example. Now, the death and cessation of their lifestyle is an act of love, if that lifestyle is inherently evil. Maybe it was an act of mercy to end such an irrational life very quickly. Not all men are the same, and not all men are necessarily human. The commandments refer to the church. In the New Testament, Christ reverses this, but he speaks only of personal enemies here. Turning the other cheek can be murderous if you refuse to defend your society from enemies. People, you know, quoting this, having no idea of the cultural background from which it springs, it's ridiculous. Of course, the apostles were all armed. Concepts like peace need to be completely reevaluated. Christ says in Luke 22, "But now the one who has a purse must take it, and likewise a bag, and one who has no sword will sell his cloak and buy one." Peace doesn't mean the absence of war. Quite the contrary, because Christ came to set people at each other's throats. We all know he came not to bring peace on earth, but a sword, to turn man against his father, daughter against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his own household in Matthew 10. There's nothing peaceful here about Christ using the modern term. Peace, however, is the existence of justice. Now, Christ, of course, cites the Old Testament all the time. He puts a seal of approval on all this. St. Augustine says peace is the proper proportion among parts of a whole. It's the result of justice. In the inner life, it's the acceptance of suffering that cleanses us of our sin. Pain and suffering are not necessarily bad things. In fact, they're often precisely what we need to reevaluate our lives. So you notice what I've done here. Every one of these terms, every one of these concepts, which is used in day-to-day life, is completely the opposite of what people think it is. And it's that way because people are dishonest, and it's that way because they insist that today's meaning must be the case 3,000 years ago. So in terms of words like peace, St. Irenaeus of Lyon, one of the students of the apostles who died in AD 130, Vincent de Lorraine, too, peace is connected to the word Catholic. Now, Catholic is a Greek word, a compound of two words, kata and holos. And what it comes down to is that the whole is manifest in the part. The whole is not the sum of the parts, or not just the sum of the parts. It means that the distinction between the person and the church no longer exists. There is no individual, nor is there any community. The community is found in each person, and each person manifests the corporate mind. Now, this is not the absorption into a machine, which is what collectivization means. It's only the realization that only as a unit do any of us realize what our purpose is. But even the Greek Catholic is related to the Latin consent. The harmony and peace in the Latin. It's also related to unanimous. You know, uni and anima of one mind or spirit. These aren't distinctive terms. They're not distinct from one another. They're essentially one and the same thing. Another maddening example is when Christ is depicted as mocking the Pharisees and really the crowd by the double standard when they're trying to stone the adulteress. What Christ was doing, of course, was attacking these people as a reprobate generation. Saying, you know what? You're probably most of you are her clients. Now, an adulterer can mean a lot of things. I've already mentioned this. It can mean a lot of things. But what does he say to her? he says, go and sin no more. In other words, whore, you did the wrong thing, but I'm giving you another chance. Because adultery was second nature to these people. And yet, of course, today it's somehow used as a, Christ as a long-haired hippie heresy. What it comes down to is that people will always project what they want into the language of Scripture without the understanding of the ancients, the nature of the audience for which this was written, and the symbols and the whole universe of meaning that these symbols have to be a part of. It's all meaningless. When people are looking at something that's meaningless to them, they tend to simply project what they want onto it. So what does this have to do when it comes to missionary work and converting people? This is, you think, but this is ridiculous. There's no way we could even approach even well-intentioned people. Well, there's certainly ways out. The 18th century Greek Cosmos Aetolian said, philosophize through your works about man's will and God's retribution, for your words are only as wise and as profitable as your works. And of course, he's at a time where society had collapsed. He was under the Turkish Empire, and essentially the Jews had ruled the economy, and he was simply not only rebuilding the church, but the state, or really the nation. Cosmos says this, it's good to help inquirers with words, but it's better to cooperate with them through prayer and the practice of virtue. For he who through these offers himself to God helps his neighbor through helping himself. And he's talking about the building of actual functional community. He says, unless someone's under your specific obedience, do not argue with people who oppose the truth, otherwise you may arouse their hatred. He also says, if someone doesn't obey you when you've told him once, do not argue, do not try to compel him, but take for yourself the profit which he has thrown away, for forbearance will benefit you more than correcting him. He also says that when someone boasts about his virtues, do not try to help him by reproving him, for a man cannot love showing off and at the same time love the truth. Remember, St. Cosmos at the time is writing under Turkish colonial rule. Clergy were very, very few. The Jewish persecutions of the faith were everywhere. Ignorance was actually enforced. So what he was talking about was converting a people who have never heard about the faith before. And of course, reviving the Greek nation as a vehicle for this, which may not be too far from what we're doing here. He was dealing with the absolute dirt poor illiterates under the oppression of the Ottoman Empire. And he was eventually murdered by the Jews who went to the Turkish governors and claimed that he was telling everyone not to pay taxes. The way to approach this kind of thing isn't through, I can give you a general intellectual outline, but I'm not so sure that this converts anyone. This may justify a conversion once it's done. Conversion is something that's done gradually. Someone doesn't lose a debate and then throw everything out the window. Disagreeing only gets people angry. You come across people who just don't understand what you're trying to say. Some will be hostile because no matter what your intention might be, you make them feel stupid. There, you stop and you avoid the issue entirely. Whether you're dealing with intellectuals, whether real or imagined, guys like me, we bleed at the touch. When we're wrong, we don't like being told that we're incorrect. Thank God for me, it happens very rarely. But I've lost many friends trying to explain these things. No matter how, there's no way of talking about this stuff without sounding pompous about it. May just be me, but this is certainly never easy. So one thing Cosmos is talking about is there's only so much that words can do. What I do, what any of the great, any philosopher can do is provide an outline of the truth, but that has nothing to do with getting you there. Now, I've always been very eccentric in the sense that I needed to read myself into a position, otherwise I can't accept it. But I don't think that's very common. I think that traumatic events, I think that suffering, and I think the collapse of a comfortable life around them is really the only way that they could come to the truth at all. So, you're approaching different books of the Bible. You have to take it into pieces. You take each part, and there are accessible works on it, including patristic works on the subject. Unfortunately, the patristic authors assume that the reader is aware of Greek ontological terms and categories. And so that becomes a problem. This certainly isn't for everybody. But Saint Ephrem the Syrian says this. In the ancient church, he says this. He who comes into contact with some share of its treasure should not think that the only thing contained in the word is what he himself has found. He should realize that he has only been able to find one thing among many others. Nor because only that one part has become his, he should say that the word is void and empty and look down upon it. But because he couldn't exhaust it, he should give thanks for its riches. Be glad that you were overcome and do not be sad that it overcame you. He's talking about limits to comprehension here. He says, the thirsty man rejoices when he drinks, and he's not downcast because he can't empty the fountain. Let the fountain quench your thirst, and then have your thirst quench the fountain. Because if your thirst is quenched and the fountain is not exhausted, you could drink from it again and again. When your thirst is quenched and the fountain is dried up, your victory will be evil. So be grateful for what you've received and don't grumble about the abundance left behind. What you have received and what you've reached is your share. What remains is your heritage. What at one time you are unable to receive because of your weakness, you'll be able to receive at other times if you persevere. Do not have the presumption to try to take on one draft what cannot be taken in one draft or abandon out of laziness what can only be taken little by little. And this is a struggle for all of us. It starts off being very cloudy and very daunting. But if you start small, if you specialize in a certain area, things get better. Revelation is a term that refers to the lifting of the veil. It manifests something that's been hidden. It's the presence of God in the church, the accepted books of the Bible, of sacramental grace, of everything else. The church fathers that put the Bible together, venerated the Mother of God, venerated the relics of saints, did believed in the real presence, had the liturgy and everything else, without fail, they all did with no exception. What we're talking about here is a content of specific manifestations of God to specific people. For many people, it's a relationship far more than a set of ideas. Ideas are highly limited in this sense. But revelation is God's presence in scripture, tradition, and the natural order. This is what we mean by logos. The church on earth, our work, is to harmonize all of these. Revelation is logos, it's Christ's presence in the world. It may be misinterpreted, it may be ignored, it might be found difficult, but nothing makes it incorrect. God the Father is not accessible to humanity. We have no conception of this unity beyond unity, which is what the Alpha Father is. Christ becoming man and manifesting the Trinity to us, that corrects the problem. God the Father, this inaccessible concept, is made accessible and manifest in Christ so he could speak to men. And we are otherwise too mired in sin to grasp anything about the spiritual life. Our knowledge is limited not so much by the information around us, but by our state of mind. Revelation that this is not hard science, because hard science can only deal with the regularity of material forces in a formal way. And that's it. And nothing more than that. And it's not really philosophy only in the sense that it doesn't deal with symbolic logic. But it is, without abandoning all that, extremely personal. And that one doesn't necessarily contradict the other. Revelation is a manifestation of God and what his purpose in creating humanity is, or at least that part of humanity that he seeks to save. It isn't so much that anything here is irrational. It's not. It's just that our sins and hang-ups are often so severe that we simply can't see reality. Revelation is cutting through human sin. If God is communicating with us, he can't do it in a way that's ambiguous or full of error. The revelation is personal rather than, you know, propositional. It's significant. Propositions have a place, but they only go so far. Well, St. Cosmos says this is about conduct and behavior. And it's so vulgar to have this checklist of beliefs that are mandatory to be a member of a church. Revelation can never be reduced to institutions. Revelation is a communication of God in historical time. It's a condescension because God is beyond time. It isn't so much that natural reason can't grasp this, although that's certainly the case with God the Father. It's that we are far too preoccupied with other things. Human reason may be able to show that God exists, but maybe not that he loves us or cares for our salvation. Reason can show that creation is ordered to a specific purpose. The nature of that purpose and how we're to get there might not be so easy to deduce. What I do, of course, is simply in the realm of ideas. That has nothing to do with getting you there. And this is what people like St. Cosmos and a friend have been talking about. That's a separate issue. For most people, truth is not a significant category. Revelation is a revealing of God's plan to humanity. But I know very few people who care. But still, history, suffering, our condition, the wretchedness of our condition right now, is not an accident. We're not subject merely to cause and effect. Christ came to destroy this chain of cause and effect. We could begin really by speaking of the ecumenical synods, because there is no Bible without them. There is no church without them, in the sense that they're, you know, in terms of their formal expression. None of the books of the Bible were put together within these synods, but the very identity of Jesus Christ, from the very students of the apostles themselves. Roughly from the Constantine era to 800, synods were called that summoned bishops, monks, and priests, and laity from around the planet to discuss these things. And, of course, one of the great things that came from it was, of course, the creed, which summarizes the faith. St. Clement of Rome, who was a very early father of the church and a student of at least several apostles, says this: "The apostles preached to us the gospel received from Jesus Christ, and Jesus was God's ambassador. Christ, in other words, comes with a message from God, and the apostles with a message from Christ. Both of these arrangements, therefore, originate from the will of God. From land to land, accordingly, and from city to city, they preached, and from the earliest converts appointed men whom they had tested by the Spirit to act as bishops and deacons for future believers. There is no separation as a church, as a visible institution, from scriptures, from sacraments. There was never this free-floating, nonsensical, puritanical idea. It never existed. No new information is being propounded here, but it's a single teaching of Christ spread throughout the world and maintained by this select group of ministers." So, we talk about a general revelation of logos, of God's presence in nature. Creation has a designer, a purpose, and it serves to teach us certain truths. But that's a very general concept. The books of the Bible, though, this is a separate issue. It's not separate, it's commensurate, but has a tendency to be more specific and to be more personal. The truths of this stuff has to be applied to specific people and times and places. The church is the primary ground of revelation. It can't produce any new information, but it can pronounce on new ways that this can be applied, especially today. The early fathers considered revelation as a manifestation of divinity in and to man. Writers like Saint Irenaeus, who personally was involved, well, one of the more significant figures in the compilation of the Bible, that revelation was not merely the written word, but the presence of the Spirit in the church. This isn't a matter of textual hermeneutics all the time. And he made it very clear that the apostolic tradition is essential. Saint Justin Martyr, Tertullian, later figures like Saint Basil and Gregory of Nyssa considered Christ as Logos. The structure of the world, the structure of thought. Reason wasn't just something that we had internally. Reason was something that was present in the world around us. The very nature of all that is, the source of truth and wisdom personified. The first thing I mentioned is this universe of meaning. The ancient world, Logos, is this truth intercommunication of all things. Revelation, therefore, is a presence of this truth, the truth that makes all lesser truths true among men. Revelation, Christ did not have or possess the truth, he was the truth. The formal structure of this, the guarantee of its objectivity, is Logos itself. E. Michael Jones has spent a lot of time explaining that when, you know, the Jews had rejected Christ, they rejected Logos. They rejected reason. They rejected the cosmic order as having any purpose, any inherent meaning. In other words, they quickly became nominalists. Nominalists have not, it's not just about universals. Nominalism is about any real meaning in the world. But at the same time, and this is the problem, is revelation can be grasped by those who are pure in intention. Those who are laden with sin will do nothing but project their sin onto what they're looking at. The sinful will distort the words that they see, the things that they come in contact with. So Saint Irenaeus, again a central figure in the putting together the New Testament, he writes on the refutation of all heresies. He says, "The Scriptures are indeed perfect, since they are spoken by the Word of God and His Spirit. But we, inasmuch as we are inferior to and later in existence than the Word of God and the Spirit, are on that very account destitute of the knowledge of His mystery. And there is no cause for wonder. This is the case with us as respects things spiritual and heavenly, and such as require to be made known to us by revelation, since many even of those things which lie at our very feet transcend our knowledge, and so even these things we must leave to God." And this is a matter of simply remaining humble. The simple fact remains, as difficult as some of this is to grasp at first blush, the Scriptures, which is not just the Bible, but also the writings of the saints and the canons and everything else, this is a record of how mankind responded to the divine message. This is why Israel is so essentially important, because Israel generally rejected the responsibilities placed upon them. The literary context of what we read isn't something dead or in the past, which is a very American way to view it. It's a living, breathing tradition. And unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of people are completely cut off from it. But the ontological assumptions of the ancient world were identical with the realities of the patristic era too. The rupture came, and I've mentioned this many times before, the fall of Constantinople in 1453, the domination of Islam over formerly Christian areas, and the rise of nominalism, the science of so-called science of the Renaissance. And it was manifest especially in the Reformation. At this point, there's this break in Western history. And words, texts, and symbols that at one time were the part and parcel of everyone's life became increasingly obscure. So it was once kind of instinctively grasped as an important verbal icon. Now it's just a word to be interpreted the way a reader wants it to be interpreted. We have a much tougher time here in 2019 than if you were born in the year 219. So what do we come down to this? You know, we have, you know, St. Polycarp, a student of St. John, St. Clement of Rome, St. Ignatius of Antioch, who were students of St. Peter. Ignoring the patristic testimony is absurd. These are the men who put the Bible together. They were charged with giving its proper, at least introductory, interpretation. Without them, you don't know anything. None of us know anything without them. Well, when we approach any of the ancient writings, you know, the scriptures, so again, not just the books of the Bible, but the so-called divine writings, the deeds of the great saints and martyrs, great emperors and everything else. There's a number of principles here that, you know, again, the great ascetics have always put forward. The literal meaning of things, which is a word that's very much overused, we have an obligation to grasp the words and phrases of you know, a specific moment in history. You have to take the political, economic, and intellectual trends seriously, you know, in the context in which these things are uttered. So once the conceptual apparatus of the era is understood, that which is obscure at first becomes much clearer. But that's not enough. The first obligation is the literal meaning, the historical product, but underneath that, the universal reality. That's not the same thing as to grasp the mystical sense available to only a few. There is both a historical context and a universal truth, and they do not contradict. And this is why the ancient authors need to be consulted on all of these things. There is no understanding without inner purity. This is an essential patristic concept. Those who struggle to live the ascetic life, you know, those of us, you know, content with a few possessions, those of us who have rejected the world in every sense, are more free than the wealthy, than the arrogant, than those who have a lot to lose. This is not an intellectual exercise, but there's an innocence of will that's essential to correct understanding. Now, this has limits, but that means that all the scriptures are to be seen as a single organism, not a bunch of disconnected works. The separation of New and Old Testament is very artificial. The concept in the prophets might only make sense when Christ makes reference to the same idea. I've mentioned many times the abuse of a word like love. It comes up all the time, and the last thing we can do, or we should do, is to put this saccharine hallmark definition onto a word like that. I almost don't like using it anymore, but it's used all the time. What is it? It's faithfulness. It's struggle. It's uncompromising commitment. It is a rejection of the world. It's the exact opposite of indulgence. Love is normally very harsh, and of course, love has absolutely no conditions. Another example is something I've said many times before, is numbers. In the ancient world, nothing was quantitative. This is a modern development. So when you see the number 40, it's not 10 times 4 days in the desert or whatever it's being referred to. It may be that, but that's not significant. As I've said before, the number 4 in both the Egyptian and Hebrew symbolism is the number of death. The square, enclosed, no way out, prison. It's our world. It's the world of sin. Totally closed to the transcendent. Number 4 represents most of us when we first get started here. Because we're concerned with satisfying our urges, which really come down to self-preservation, it doesn't take long for any knowledge of God to be completely effaced. This is what the square is. This is what Christ was crucified on, the 4 points of the cross. Numbers are icons. These are forms of almost infinite depth. So when you see a number like 7 or 40, they're not numbers. They're not numerals. Right? There's no 12. It's the number 3 because, the unity of the Father and division of heaven and earth. Suffering 3 is Gemel or the camel. We even still has kind of the camel humps in the Arabic version of the numeral. It's a camel that gets you through the desert. It gets you through our situation. when you separate God the Father from number two of the world, you get a desert. You get death. Only the number three, the symbolic icon of number three, the camel, which is the church, which is the Trinity, can bring you through. Now, people end up reading, the favorite one to use all is the prophet Elijah. I love Elijah because he was today, of course, he'd be in prison. He calls down fire to burn up the pagan priests of Baal, which, by the way, is an act of love in the ancient definition. It's a confrontation between not so much two faiths, so to speak. I don't like that word anymore. But the immediate context is civilization and the form of that civilization. In the book, the context here concerns other events. So Elijah, when God tells him to confront the priests of Baal, what does he do? He complains. He says, I'm alone. I'm up against hundreds of people. They're far more powerful than I. They have everything that I don't. And God says, well, you do it anyway. Because if, you know, when you win, it's not going to be because of you. So in the following chapter, when Elijah says the Israelites should know better than the pagans, that his own people are just as bad as anybody else, there's a clear reference that Elijah is completely alone. It refers to the fact that Israelites had murdered the rest of the prophets, which they did all the time, by the way. So the broadened context here is the victory of Elijah over the pagans is just a prelude, because Israel will soon suffer a similar fate. Because it will put to death the prophets. Christ makes explicit reference to this. But the context here, you know, this is why Elijah is an icon for the whole church. His role in doing battle alone is a lot of all of us, anyone who remains faithful. But God guarantees the victory, not because we're so wonderful, but because we're so weak. The true church will always be small. So you see, you take one event, you know, the killing of the priests of Baal, which gets everyone very upset because, you know, death is the worst thing that could ever happen. No, it's an act of love. This is something that God has commanded explicitly. Obviously, God doesn't love everyone the same, because these people, their earthly journey is at an end. They're leading lives that are ridiculously irrational and harmful and damaging. And to end it is the best thing they could possibly do. Now, this isn't something that you can universalize as you see fit. But there is no... I mean, the Old Testament is here for a reason. These things sound obscure at first. They become extremely important later. The Tower of Babel in Genesis is replaced by the New Jerusalem in Revelation. The confusion of languages at Babel is reversed by the mutual understanding of languages at Pentecost. Now, I know this has been very confusing and difficult. And so let me summarize here as briefly as I can, or as clearly as I can. We live in a society that is extremely degenerate. There is no connection with any reality whatsoever. It is simply words that get defined by those with power. And they get defined by those with power only because they have power. Power is its own reward. It's a circular, ridiculous concept that produces a population that increasingly is really incapable of communication, incapable of thought. There's a few of us. I mean, I'm one of them, certainly, some of you are, that for whatever godforsaken reason have been plucked out of the blissful world of ignorance and put on this path of understanding what logos truly is, what the truth really is. The problem is that when we go to ancient texts, you know, the Bible most especially, but any of the ancient texts, Plato, Aristotle, Polybius, it doesn't matter. We are so far removed from that universe of meaning and so far removed from any comprehension of objective reality. The things that, you know, if these people were alive today, they would go mad. They would say there is simply no way to reform. There's nothing you can do. It's absolutely disgusting. These people are disgusting. I would love to take someone like, you know, a great ascetic father like John the Faster and send him to an American university for a week of classes. Let's see how well he does. He would be throwing himself off of the nearest bridge. It is absolutely unprecedented, and it's evil. So then how can a product of that go to the New Testament or Plato, anything like that, and get any benefit out of it? And the simple answer is that he can't. For someone like that, even with good intentions, to read the New Testament is an act of blasphemy. Because all he's going to do, regardless of what he really wants, is simply import degenerate meanings onto a context, onto a literary context, onto words and phrases that have no relation to this postmodern world. What that does is it puts a responsibility on us that's absolutely crushing. It's thankless. It's a terrible life. It's a thankless life because most people who you talk to, even those who are sympathetic, won't really comprehend where you're going. They won't comprehend why this is worth, you know, dedicating an entire life to. They don't understand things that don't have a cash value, not necessarily in money, but in some kind of payoff. Not that metaphor is used all the time. So approaching things like metaphysics, or poetry or theology is laughable. Even for those who realize the value, but they'll say to you, well, what are you going to do with that? Which is what really triggered me when I was younger. It's simply saying already, it's an admission that there is no room for truth in modern society because the answer is nothing. I started saying to make you feel as uncomfortable as possible. Because I knew even back then that I was going to do everything I could to expose the lies and the hypocrisy of modern pseudo-morality. And the fact that it's based solely on the will to power. It's based solely on violence and power of one kind or another. Dostoevsky's The Idiot is one of my favorite books of all time because The Idiot is In the true Greek sense of the word, someone outside of civilization. Idiot has a clinical, although archaic, clinical definition. But it's Greek conception. We get the word, you know, idiosyncratic from it. We get the word, you know, anything, idiorhythm, something that is purely personal, something outside of society. Now, normally that's a bad thing. We talked about the underground man. The underground man is certainly an idiot. In the true sense of the word, that's not a bad thing when you consider that it is a separation from degeneracy. If it was a separation from a healthy society, it would be another matter. And believe it or not, there have been healthy societies in the past. The main issue is that he had no conception of power. He saw everyone pursuing self-interest around him. Unhappy, of course, unfulfilled, because there's really no way to fulfill someone like that. But he himself was equally miserable. Or at the very least, he had this simplistic sense of righteousness that he could never see actually come to pass. Doesn't mean he was wrong. The idiot is, I mean, this is a cursory summary, but, you know, I also think Diary of a Madman and Gogol is something very similar. Somebody who, the underground man, you know, is something I've identified with this guy in the past, which is not a great thing, but that's what becomes of those of us who refuse to accept the postmodern consensus. How in heaven's name can you preach the Psalms or preach the Old Testament or preach anything like this in a society that doesn't even recognize the concept of love, or have any conception or the idea of actual community. That doesn't even, it can't even define death properly. It doesn't even know, or what knowledge is, or any objectivity whatsoever. There is no point of commensurability between someone like me and a well-intentioned, educated person outside. It is a lifetime of struggle. It's a lifetime of suffering to attach yourself to the ascetic life and hope for the best, hoping that God will take care of you. Because that's pretty much all we got. We've covered a lot of ground here. I know we covered it very, very quickly. The basic concept is we're dealing with a not just a foreign civilization, actually more than one foreign civilization, but one that's at war with this one. That's how bad things have gotten, and we recognize already that we can hardly communicate with those around us. This is not a judgment. I mean, we're not condemning anybody. It's that they don't know any better. And sometimes I wish I didn't know any better. But this is what I'm called to do, and I know many of you are called to do. It doesn't mean any of this is wrong. It's just there's really nothing you can do with it. The idiot, the underground man, the one person that's pure, I don't mean pure in the sense of perfect or, you know, virtuous, but is properly ordered mentally, being put in the ultimate disorder. It's almost comedic what you're going to get. You'll get the idiot, you know, in Dostoevsky, you'll get Diary of a Madman, or you'll get, you know, something like this, or ultimately the underground man in Dostoevsky. We know Christ spoke the truth because he didn't promise us anything but this kind of pain. He's not like, you know, Muhammad, who promised us, you know, women and food and everything else, you know, the most vulgar descriptions of heaven. No, all he promised us is this kind of pain, but the fulfillment of these desires on a metaphysical and ontological level, in the future. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.